from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Unanimous approval of a Russian initiative for Ukraine that may finally bring peace to that troubled country. On Tuesday, the UN Security Council endorsed the so-called package of measures adopted and signed in Minsk last week to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. The resolution presented by Russia was unanimously adopted by the 15-member council. This was Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, at the Security Council Tuesday.
Thank you, Mr. President. We're grateful to members of the Council for their unanimous adoption of the Russian Federation's draft resolution in support of the arrangements to settle the Ukrainian crisis reached in Minsk on the 12th of February. The events that have taken place in the year of the conflict in the territory of that country have been truly tragic. Thousands have died. Many towns and villages in eastern Ukraine have been practically destroyed. Over a million civilians have left the conflict zone, the vast majority of whom have sought shelter in Russian territory. We believe that now, after the 12th February, the unprecedented diplomatic efforts undertaken in Minsk on 12th of February of the highest leadership of Russia, France, Germany and Ukraine, there's a genuine opportunity for Ukraine to turn the tragic page in her history. We support our high assessment of the adoption on the 12th of February of the package of measures for the implementation of the Minsk agreements and the declaration of the four leaders. We're fully willing to facilitate implementation of these arrangements. The Minsk agreements must be fully complied with by all sides. We need to avoid adoption of unilateral measures that would contradict the letter and spirit of the documents adopted and signed in Minsk on the 12th of February 2015. Since the very start of the crisis, Russia has actively called for a peaceful settlement through inclusive, transparent dialogue between the sides in the internal Ukrainian conflict, and it's done its utmost to ensure that open conversations be established on fundamental political and constitutional issues. We will adhere to this fundamental approach in the future also. I thank you, President.
Although the vote was unanimous, the tone of the discussion was nevertheless acrimonious, with the U.S. Permanent Representative Samantha Power taking the occasion to once again blame Russia for fighting in Ukraine.
Thank you. We've gotten used to living in an upside-down world with respect to Ukraine. Russia speaks of peace and then fuels conflict. Russia signs agreements and then does everything within its power to undermine them. Russia champions the sovereignty of nations and then acts as if a neighbor's borders do not exist. Yet even for those of us growing accustomed to living in an upside-down world, the idea that Russia, which manufactured and continues to escalate the violence in Ukraine, has tabled a resolution today calling for the council for the conflict's peaceful solution is ironic, to say the least. Bitterly ironic, given that this council has dedicated some 30 meetings to calling on Russia to stop escalating the very same conflict, and given the human consequences that are growing daily. Even as Russia puts forward this resolution, separatists that Russia has trained, armed, and that it fights alongside are laying ruthless and deadly siege to the Ukrainian-held city of Debalcheva, approximately 30 to 40 kilometers beyond lines established by the September Minsk agreements. Throughout the day, we've heard conflicting reports as to whether Debalcheva has fallen. According to press reports, the so-called road of life leading out of Debalcheva has become a road of death, littered with the bodies of Ukrainian soldiers. At just the time this council is calling for the ceasefire that was supposed to take effect Saturday night at midnight, Russia is backing an all-out assault. We do not know how many civilians are left in Debalcheva because Russia and the separatists it supports have refused to guarantee the safety of impartial OSCE monitors who've been trying for days to enter the area, a commitment that in this upside-down world, Russia and the separatists made on February 12th at Minsk. But we know from credible press reports that thousands of civilians in Debalcheva and neighboring villages have been sheltering from heavy shelling in dank basements, often without running water, food, electricity, or basic medical supplies. We know that many of the civilians left who are enduring the terror of this relentless assault are the elderly and small children, people who could not evacuate on their own. And even with such limited information, we know with certainty that at the same time that Russia signs on to yet another agreement committing itself to de-escalation and peace, forces that Russia trains, equips, and joins on the battlefield have only escalated this fighting, grabbing more territory and killing the Ukrainian soldiers who stand in their way. We are caught in a deadly feedback loop. International leaders engage in rigorous, exhaustive negotiations to get Russia to commit to peace in Geneva, in Normandy, in September in Minsk, in Berlin in February, and then again in Minsk on February 12th when the implementations were signed, and now in New York. Yet Russia's commitments have no bearing on the actions of its soldiers and the separatists they back on the ground. Mr. President, the United States has maintained the same position across 30 meetings before this council with respect to Ukraine. Let me reiterate that position. We are for peace in Ukraine. We are for Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, territorial integrity, and unity. We are for ending the violence in eastern Ukraine that has taken more than 5,600 lives since last April and displaced already approximately 1 million people. We are for all of the signatories to the agreements signed in Minsk in September 2014, particularly Russia and the separatists they back, fulfilling the commitments that they have made. And we are for the package of measures for the implementation of the Minsk agreements of September 5 and September 19th, the package of measures endorsed last week by the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France. To be clear, the February 12th implementation package is a roadmap to fulfilling commitments made by these same signatories in the September Minsk agreements. President Hollande, President Poroshenko, Chancellor Merkel, and President Putin each made this clear when they endorsed the implementation package on February 12th and issued their joint declaration that they, quote, remain committed to the implementation of the Minsk agreements, end quote. The Minsk agreements, in the title, plural, refer to those signed on September 5 and September 19th by the same signatories, while the measures for implementation, in the title, make clear that the February 12th package was designed to begin carrying out the September agreements and not to supplant them, as Russia has now begun to argue. The United States rejects any interpretation of this resolution that would abrogate the parties' earlier commitments. All parties must implement all of the commitments made in the September Minsk agreements. The implementation steps agreed upon in the February 12th package include a comprehensive ceasefire, the withdrawal of heavy weapons from the September line of contact, the release of all hostages, and the eventual restoration of Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and control of its international border. Too often, debates in this council occur in a vacuum, removed from the real world. In the real world, a man named Alexei Kravchenko, a 73-year-old in the Ukrainian-held town of Svitlodarsk, near Debalcheva, recently told a reporter that he had spent nights huddled together with his grandchildren in a bomb shelter on his property as shelling continued through the night. Alexei told the reporter that his grandchildren said to him in the shelter, "Grandpa, I don't want to die young." He said, "I held my grandchildren and they were shaking, and I looked in their eyes and they were afraid." With the February 12th agreement, Alexei said, "Now we are hoping." The fighting, unfortunately, has in fact increased dramatically near Alexei's home. But we call on Russia to translate hope into real action, to translate hope into real results, and to do so urgently. Today's council session is an effort to throw the council's weight behind an agreement already jeopardized by statements by the separatists dismissing the full ceasefire, by their continued attacks on Debalcheva, and by the separatists' refusal, together with Russia's, to allow access to the OSCE special monitoring mission. We are looking to Russia, which manufactured and fueled this conflict, to leave the upside-down world it has created and to honor the resolution it tabled today, supporting efforts to end it.
Despite the acrimony, many saw passage of the resolution as an opportunity to bring peace to the war-torn country, as Derek Mbata reports.
In its unanimously adopted resolution, the Security Council welcomed the declaration by the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany, adopted on the 12th of February in Minsk, Belarus. The declaration contains what has been called a package of measures for the implementation of the Minsk agreements, including a ceasefire. Ambassador Jim McClay of New Zealand said it was no secret that over the past 4 days, the Security Council had struggled to negotiate a mutually acceptable text for the resolution. He said that struggle was hardly surprising given the nature of the matter, the history of the conflict, and the active support of troops and material that the separatists continue to receive.
Those problems should not, Mr. President, however, obscure the very simple truth that, above all, our combined objective must be to see an end to the fighting in eastern Ukraine, a genuine and holding ceasefire with lives saved as a result, to see respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and to see an end to external support for the separatists.
The Security Council called on all parties in the conflict in Ukraine to fully implement the packages of measures, including a comprehensive ceasefire as provided for in that package. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Last week, during the marathon 14-hour discussion in Minsk that led to the ceasefire agreement, Russia's President Vladimir Putin had repeatedly brought up the matter of a large Ukrainian army force that was encircled by rebel forces in the eastern city of Debaltseve. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, however, repeatedly denied that the force was encircled and instead took the position that the force was occupying the city and thus did not need to be incorporated into the agreement. But within days, it became apparent that the force was, in fact, completely cut off by the rebels, and Tuesday, the officers of the Ukrainian force had abandoned their posts, leaving their troops in a state of disarray. Soon thereafter, the troops began to lay down their arms, and by Wednesday, they had, in the main, left the city altogether. After the retreat, Poroshenko continued to maintain that his troops hadn't surrendered, but had simply completed their assignment, as RT's Murad Gazdiev reports from the region.
The Ukrainian commander-in-chief, President Poroshenko, has announced an organized retreat from the town of Debaltseve after ferocious fighting there. But why Debaltseve was needed in the first place, he explained.
We can say that the Ukrainian armed forces completed their task fully. We needed this territory and success during the Minsk talks. We have proved that Debaltseve was under our control and there was no encirclement.
Ukrainian officers and commanders are said to have retreated from Debaltseve, leaving behind as many as thousands of troops who are demoralized, hungry, they're short on food, short on rations, short on ammunition, and their situation is really quite desperate.
It was very difficult. We couldn't even get food or water.
I don't know. Our commanders didn't tell us whether it's a retreat or just a rotation. They just told us to change our position because our unit had been there for quite a long time and we suffered a lot of losses.
There are still hundreds and hundreds of Ukrainian troops, and it's unclear exactly how many that are still trapped inside that pocket. Some are still offering resistance, but many have chosen to surrender instead. The anti-government forces in the east have offered them safe passage. They've offered to guarantee their safety if they choose to surrender, lay down their arms, leave behind their armor, heavy artillery, and the likes. Vladimir Putin, in fact, himself urged Ukrainian authorities, Ukrainian military commanders, not to persecute soldiers who choose to surrender in such desperate circumstances. But Debaltseve is an isolated incident, as the front line largely is quiet. Artillery has stopped firing across most of the front. In fact, the anti-government forces have begun withdrawing heavy weapons from the front lines. Here in Donetsk, the situation is even calmer. So optimism is high and a lot of hope that this ceasefire will hold.
Late Tuesday, Russia's TASS news agency had reported that Ukraine's army was pulling heavy weapons closer to Debaltseve with the apparent aim of providing an escape route to the trapped Ukrainian units. The report had said that hundreds of Ukrainian troops had already surrendered to militias over the previous 24 hours and quoted a spokesperson for the Defense Ministry of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic Tuesday as saying, quote, according to our information, the Ukrainian Army Command declares those who surrender traitors to the country, closed quote. There were no reports yet as of Wednesday on the fate of those Ukrainian troops who had withdrawn. Meanwhile, there was another ceasefire offer made at the UN Tuesday. This one, an apparent attempt to stop the killing in Syria. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bashar Ja'afari, said he received indications from the Syrian government that it's willing to halt all aerial bombing and artillery shelling over the city of Aleppo for a period of 6 weeks in order to find an accord. We have this report from Press TV.
The UN envoy to Syria says that he has received indications from the Syrian government that they are willing to halt all types of aerial bombing and artillery shelling on the city of Aleppo for a period of 6 weeks.
I would read, because there are quite a few points that I want to brief you about in order to also be accurate on this. I briefed today the Security Council on the latest developments, and also the latest information and news on the acceleration of the military activities north and near Aleppo, and the retaliation inside the city. All this is a stark reminder of the urgency to at least spare the civilian population of Aleppo, and frankly not only Aleppo, Dura and many other places, from the tragic effects of heavy weapons and aerial bombing. I also, in this connection, once more clarified the press comments that I did. You want to? Okay, you want to do any translation? You think it's a club? No, okay. Okay, I also once more wanted to actually clarify the press comments that I made in Vienna the other day, on Friday, because I wanted to make sure that everyone understand that what I was referring to, and there is no other reference, was that I believe that the government of Syria, which has aerial and artillery capacities, should partake of any solution to the reduction of violence on civilian population. In this connection, especially in light of the latest worrisome news of heavy fighting near Aleppo, I have requested the government of Syria to facilitate a UN mission to identify one district inside Aleppo in order to use it as an example of what could be the benefit for the population if there is a freeze. The government of Syria has indicated to me its willingness to halt all aerial bombing, all sorts, all types of aerial bombing and artillery shelling for a period of 6 weeks all over the city of Aleppo, from a date which we will be announcing from Damascus. I plan, therefore, to proceed to both Damascus and hopefully to Aleppo as soon as possible. I will also send a preparatory team to Aleppo as soon as possible. Let's be frank, I have no illusions, because based on past experiences, this will be a difficult issue to be achieved. But we will engage also very much the opposition, hopefully to see them to respond to a similar request from the UN to halt mortar and rockets on all over the city of Aleppo for 6 weeks. No illusions, but a dim of hope, bearing in mind that it is our duty to protect civilians, Syrian civilians, wherever we can, while we are still hoping to find a political solution. It is like a disease, I said. When you don't have a treatment, you don't have a cure, but you have to insist in reducing at least this type of violence from the heaviest weapons, and engage all those who have weapons to actually follow that. We shall be cautious, and words and assurances will not be enough. Facts on the ground will prove if the freeze holds and can be replicated elsewhere. The implementation of Resolution 2170, the one about terrorism, 2178, the one about foreign fighters, 2139 about access of humanitarian aid regarding these areas are crucial in order to make sure that the freeze will be serious, sustainable, if it takes place, and produce results. Meanwhile, we will also pursue the political process which Cairo Moscow have generated and actually build on it with a UN initiative. Since the purpose, frankly, is to spare as many civilian victims as possible while the political process based on the Geneva Communique and a pragmatic approach can produce results. That's basically a summary of our discussion. And you have to forgive me, but I'm not taking any questions.
No. This is a modest achievement that you're talking about, sir. You raised very high expectations the last time, and then now you're talking about a modest achievement. What can you say about that?
When you save lives, there is never a modest achievement. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What about the opposition? Council, don't you see that there is a message for you, because you have not determined when this lull, the ceasefire, this whatever in the district that you're talking about will begin? The fact that there was an escalation today, how do you condemn it?
Every time there is a proposal of a ceasefire, every time you try to have a ceasefire, history has proven that there is some type of acceleration in order to take a better position from any sides. And I fear that that could be the case. But we are not going to give up in insisting on stopping aerial bombing, any type of artillery, but on the other side, mortar and rockets.
Staffan de Mistura did not indicate any dates as when the suspension of airstrikes would begin. He also called the new development a glimmer of hope and continued to emphasize on a political solution to the nearly four-year conflict. Political commentator and journalist Mr. Gerard Ocolme joins us now from the French capital, Paris. Sir, welcome to the program. Talk to us more about the willingness expressed by the Syrian government to implement this ceasefire on the city of Aleppo, and how effective can these localized ceasefires be, which effectively lead to the free flow of humanitarian aid as well?
First of all, the Syrian government have expressed openly the wish from the very start of this conflict to negotiate. They have always expressed a desire to have dialogue. That has been very, very clear from the start. The big problem with dealing with the United Nations is that the United Nations is effectively an extension of U.S. power, of the U.S. government, and of U.S. policy. And so any attempts to negotiate with the U.N. are really attempts to negotiate with the United States. The United States has not relinquished their desire for regime change. In fact, they have continued to arm and train the so-called moderate rebels, who are referred to as the Free Syrian Army in Turkey. This Free Syrian Army does not really exist. It's mostly made up of al-Qaeda jihadist terrorists. I think this attempt to have negotiations with the Syrian government is a sign that the Syrian Arab Army is effectively liberating the country. In other words, they are about to take Aleppo, and NATO is in crisis. It's a deep crisis also forced in Ukraine, where they have failed to put down the rebellion there. So I think that at the moment, this is a sign that NATO is looking for a way out. Of course, there is another clause here, and this is that they are using ISIS to put pressure on the Syrian government. In other words, they are probably using the threat of an escalation if the Syrian government doesn't call a ceasefire. So the Syrian government will certainly listen to the proposals, but whether or not they would be advised to follow them is another question, because they have the upper hand in Aleppo. And it would, of course, give the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian people enormous courage if they were to finally liberate Aleppo from the terrorists. So it's very difficult to say what the Syrian government will do. I'm sure they will try to enter into some sort of negotiation with the UN on this.
After last week's reports of an attempted coup in Venezuela, which the government said was orchestrated by the U.S., and involved opposition officials and senior military staff, there are now reports of a coup attempt underway in Argentina, using the recent death of an Argentine prosecutor who had targeted the country's leftist president as a rallying point. Telesur's Cody Weddle has more.
A group of opposition attorneys and judges will march today in Buenos Aires to pay tribute to the late attorney Alberto Nisman. The event has sparked controversy, though, as the Argentinian government considers the move an attempt to politicize the case of Nisman. The opposition has tried to accuse the government of a high-level cover-up, while other analysts and lawyers have ridiculed claims that President Cristina Fernandez was somehow involved. Nisman was found dead in his apartment on January 18th under suspicious circumstances. For more now on this planned march, we go to our correspondent in Argentina, Leno Poletti Caruti.
Yes, a march labeled the March of Silence will be held this Wednesday evening here on the downtown streets of Buenos Aires, marking the one-month anniversary since the death of prosecutor Alberto Nisman. It has been called by a very, very small group of prosecutors, and it must be said that Viviana Fein, who is the prosecutor in charge of investigating Nisman's death, does not take part of that small group of prosecutors calling on this march for this Wednesday evening here in Buenos Aires. Also, members of the opposition have announced that they will attend the march, and all of the experts consulted by Telesur in the last few days have agreed that this Wednesday's march is a highly politicised event which seeks to erode the national government's image. Now, even though the march has not yet taken place, it has enjoyed hours upon hours of airtime on Argentina's monopolised mainstream media, which has a large bias against the government of Cristina Fernandez. Now, various leading judicial and political figures have said that they will not attend the march, signalling those who do so are opportunists who look to destabilise the government in a new pledge of a soft coup here in Argentina. Reporting from Buenos Aires, Leo Politicuti for From the South on Telesur.
The Argentine Military Center for Democracy, or SEMIDA, said in a statement Tuesday that right-wing opposition forces within the country are using the case in order to undermine the government of President Cristina Fernandez as cover for a soft coup. The Congressional Black Caucus is silent when Israel passes discriminatory laws, steals Palestinian land, and or punishes Palestinian civilians with power and water cutoffs and blockades. Its threatened walkout on Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in his address to Congress next month isn't because it disapproves of Israeli apartheid funded by U.S. tax dollars, but only because Bibi insulted the first black president. So says Bruce Dixon of BlackAgendaReport.com, who offered this commentary.
Nobody celebrates victories against racism and apartheid a generation or two back more often or more lavishly than the Congressional Black Caucus. It's something they have to do constantly, not just because some of those victories made their career possible, but because apart from those careers, they have not really accomplished much in the last 40 years. From the 1990s onward, most of them voted for legislation that doubled down on the war on drugs and to intensify the over-policing and mass incarceration in their own communities. When it became clear that Katrina was the excuse to dispossess and disperse into exile a couple hundred thousand black people on the Gulf Coast, the Black Caucus called no hearings. It sounded no alarms. And despite their relentless celebrations of victories over racism, the entire Black Caucus has consistently turned a blind eye to the brutal settler state apartheid of Israel. The CBC's promise to skip out when Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu addresses the U.S. Congress on March 5 is not an act of vision or moral courage. When Israel demolishes Palestinian houses, when it lynches and deports Africans, when Israel passes more discriminatory laws and steals Palestinian land, the Congressional Black Caucus says nothing. Let's be clear. Netanyahu is a demagogic racist. He heads the planet's most vicious apartheid regime, a U.S.-supported and funded client state engaged in the conquest and occupation of neighboring territories and the genocidal dispossession and exile of their populations, all paid for with U.S. tax dollars and under U.S. diplomatic cover. And this is beneath the CBC's notice. But let somebody insult or disparage the First Lady, and they'll be all over that. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.